Mark Pesce is with us now. Morning, welcome, Mark.
Good morning.
Now, Gordon Moore, I was going to undertake and decided, thought better of it, the explanation of a very important principle. I'm not sure if it still holds, actually, but it certainly did for a very long time, called Moore's Law. He has just died, Gordon Moore, at 94 in Hawaii. Tell us more about his importance.
So I think if you want to talk about the world that we live in today, this is Gordon Moore's world. We really do just live in it. In 1965, when he was one of the few and one of the leading people who were learning how to make higher and higher density semiconductors, so integrated circuits with many chips, he wrote an article for a paper which really just talked about cramming more transistors onto a piece of silicon. And he said, look, you know, the rate we're going, basically every 18 to 24 months, we can double the number of transistors we can put on a piece of silicon and sell you for a dollar. And you know, probably this is going to last for about the next 10 years. So that was 1965. He said, oh, by 1975, we'll be able to put 65,000 transistors on a piece of silicon. And everyone went, wow. And what happened was when he made this announcement and he showed how mathematically it was going to happen, the entire industry started to predicate what it could do based on that theory, which became known as Moore's Law. So the fact that a company could plan to release a faster or cheaper or more powerful computer or other thing, an electric alarm clock, a digital watch, and know how much it would cost to be able to put that on someone's wrist or on someone's bed table is because of Moore's Law. But the key thing is Moore's Law didn't run for 10 years. It ran uninterrupted for at least 50 years to about 2015. It hit a couple of bumps on the road, but actually now we're back on track again.
So explain to me, is it? I've never quite fully understood it, or I just can't remember it. Every 7 years, the power, the capacity, the watt of computers doubles. What is it?
So every 18 to 24 months, and that's where it gets a little wobbly because there can be things to speed it up or slow it down. On a given piece of silicon, you can etch, you can create double the number of transistors that you could 18 months before that. And because of the way all of these processes work, that means basically for the same cost, you're getting double the power.
Did he and can you explain the mathematics behind this?
So effectively what it meant was what we were doing is we were learning more and more about how to manipulate silicon. And we use a whole bunch of other materials when we make chips now. But every time we make a chip, we get a little bit better at making a chip. That's actually just a normal manufacturing process. And semiconductors had fallen into that basic manufacturing process where every time you make a chip, you get better at making the next chip. And in a cadence, what that means is that effectively it doubles improvement every 18 to 24 months.
Okay. So it had got wobbly, but are you saying now it is back on track again?
It looks like it's back on track again. One of the corollaries to Moore's Law is that every generation of chips, although you can do twice as much in half the scale, those chip plants cost twice as much. And now that that doubling has also gone on for a while, the latest generation of chip plants, which they're building in Taiwan and in the United States and in Europe, these plants cost at a minimum $20 billion. And that means the generation after that will cost minimum $40 billion. So the question isn't how small things are going to get. It's can we afford to build the plants to make things that small?
Well, the interesting thing with the chips, of course, is where they are produced, right? And if I am correct, is it Taiwan that has a massive dominance in the actual production? And are we seeing efforts in the United States now to try and bring back some more domestic production? Is the administration not investing in this?
Yeah, they have a semiconductor fund, I think $50 billion. So Gordon Moore went on after this paper to co-found Intel. And Intel makes the chips that run in all of the PCs in the world, all right? And so he became a multi-billionaire and a philanthropist and really drove the computer into our everyday lives. Intel still makes billions of chips, but they focused on just making their own chips, whereas the Taiwanese said, we're going to make chips for everyone. And so many people need chips today, they actually got more business than Intel did. The more business you get, the better you get at making chips. And now TSMC, which is the main manufacturer, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, they are the undisputed kings of making chips. They have been invited by the Americans to set up factories in America to bring their technology over. So this is really the first time in history that we've had a semiconductor technology transfer from another country into America.
All right. And his own story, was he an engineer originally or what?
He was very much an engineer and started off very early working for a man named William Shockley, who's one of the co-inventors of the transistor, who had a small group of people to make early transistor products. Shockley was a horrible human being, and the eight key engineers quit. They were called the Traitorous Eight, and set up Fairchild Semiconductor, which was the very first integrated circuit firm. They did that for a decade, and then he and Robert Noyce went off and founded Intel for integrated electronics. And that then started the rise of the microprocessor, because the microprocessor comes to us from Gordon Moore and Robert Noyce.
Now, chips and everything. This links us to your next story.
Yes. So we have a bit of a lawsuit going on right now in America between the Internet Archive, which is basically trying to keep a copy of everything on the Internet, and the four big book publishers. So that's Hachette, HarperCollins, Penguin, Random House. Wiley is the fifth. And what they're doing is they're trying to say that the Internet Archive, by scanning physical books that people have donated to it and making those available on a library lending process so that only one person can get to them at a time, that it's undercutting the publisher's digital licensing rights. And they went to court last week. The Internet Archive actually showed that the publishers have been making more money every year. This hasn't affected their bottom lines, but the publishers are saying, well, actually, we would be making even more money if you weren't doing this. And the judge ruled against the Internet Archive last week. So now we're in this point where digital rights for books look like they're being grabbed back by publishers, which may affect not just the Internet Archive, but every library that wants to offer a digital copy of a book that they bought from a publisher.
Wow. And just to explain what's driving this, this is a legal case?
This is a basic.
Who's making the judgments?
So the judge, right now it's been, I think it's just a federal circuit court. It looks like this is headed through an appeals process and might even eventually end up at the Supreme Court. But it is really an argument about digital rights in the digital age. If I have a physical copy of a book, why can't I scan that book and then lend it to someone else, as long as I'm only lending it to one person at a time? And the publishers are asserting that digital rights in the contract are different. They're going to be dealt with differently. We will charge more money for them. And I think the Internet Archive is really asking everyone, is this a property right that we want to give publishers? Because where does that take us?
Where does it take us, Mark?
Well, I mean, it could very well be that libraries themselves will have to spend their limited budgets on very expensive digital copies so that they can lend those digitally to their readership. People who don't live close to a physical library may have much more restricted access to library catalogs. One of the things that happened was during the global lockdowns in 2020, the Internet Archive basically took the restrictions off and they said, look, we're a global library. You can't get to the physical library right now because you're locked down. Here's all of our books. Please read them. And so it helped a lot of people at least keep themselves entertained and informed during those lockdowns. And they really think this is an important thing that libraries, and they're making the point, libraries have been around far longer than publishers have. And perhaps we need to think about their rights before we think about publishers.
Very interesting stuff and a long way to go by the sounds of it. Now, let's get into AI. Such big proclamations around ChatGPT, and particularly ChatGPT-4, and as more and more people begin to learn about its abilities, so to speak, people are forecasting it as the next big, massive revolution affecting everything, really. Bill Gates now, who's been around a while, has come out saying the age of AI has begun.
Yeah, and bless Bill, because he is a bit late to this party, but he also was a bit late to the internet party. But he published a very, very insightful essay last week. And he said, look, I've seen two revolutions. I saw the first graphical user interface, you know, before he used that to create Windows. And he said the second big surprise was when he saw OpenAI and how far they have come since they were founded in 2016. So he's really talking about ChatGPT and GPT-4. And he's really asking us to take stock of all of the different ways that it will be used and possibly now start to think about all the different ways it will disrupt the ways we work. And so, you know, one of the things we need to look at here is the unexpected uses of AI. It's not just going to be used to help kids write an essay or to help you do some research, but there is an example that has been highlighted recently where ChatGPT-4 effectively used deceit and deception to get through one of those CAPTCHA codes that you have to type into a website to prove that you're not a robot. So this is a robot that had enough both awareness of itself as a robot and enough connections to the outside world that it basically hired a worker on, I think, TaskRabbit to solve the CAPTCHA for them. And when the worker asked them point blank, are you a robot? It lied.
So explain to me how machine learning learns to lie.
This is a very good question, Catherine, because large language models, ChatGPT, basically they just read everything. And so basically what they do is they're trying to retrieve from their memory what the most likely next thing to say is. And presumably they'd seen enough examples in the text of humans writing about lying or humans being quoted lying that they simply knew that this was the right action to take.
You see, this does confuse me a little because we hear of AI, as you say, not being particularly creative, not creating something new out of its extraordinary statistical ability to assess a ton of information at once. And yet there seems to be something creative about coming up with a very specific lie.
yeah, I mean, there is, although I think there's also a body of work about whether a robot will lie to you when you ask it if it's a robot. So it may very well be that there is enough of a history here that it had something to go on. I don't think we're seeing something that is, in that sense, a completely new thought that no AI system has ever had before. But I agree with you. It's falling into this very ambiguous territory because if these systems pass what we used to call the Turing test, whereas if you're just engaging them in a text conversation and you can't tell whether you're talking to a person or a robot, and they don't reveal that they're a robot, how do you guide your own expectations or your own projections onto that system about whether you're talking to a person or a robot? And that is not a new question. That question has been being asked for about 80 years now.
Well, the great irony is the question asked by the CAPTCHA or ReCAPTCHA, which is uses a security access for any number of sites we'll be on,
yeah.
Oh, is,
yeah.
I am not a robot.
Yeah.
It could
yeah.
not get more specific. And so something that is a robot managed to find a way around this. What are the implications of it, though, Mark? Again, because we've got companies now wanting to use, and some already are, using these applications for everything from, you know, potentially crunching legal, what a legal secretary would do right now, to writing code.
Yeah.
And what are the implications if this new employee, say, is a capable
liar?
Who
is dishonest.
We're already dealing with that in the human form. But with the amount of trust and again, these issues of how you're going to make sure you're getting what you want out of the extraordinary computing power here, What does this curveball mean?
So I think what it is a good thing to remind us of is that there is no such thing as a free lunch. You know, people are very excited by AI because it kind of looks like a machine that's going to give you everything you want without a price. And it's becoming clearer now that there is a price. And part of the price is some level of human oversight. So you can detect whether these things are, quote unquote, hallucinating, which is making things up, or out and out lying. And it feels like you know, as we move the bar on what we want our machines to do and what we want our humans to be doing, it's pretty clear that one of the things our humans are going to be doing is as much truth-telling as possible. The question here is we're now going to be in a bit of an arms race because these machines will get more and more capable of telling us things that will pass a sniff test but may not actually be true.
Who's calling for a pause on AI and what chance do they stand?
Yeah, so basically, you know, yesterday a big public letter went out signed at the top by Elon Musk and Steve Wozniak, one of the founders of Apple, basically saying they call on AI labs to immediately pause for at least 6 months the training of AI systems more powerful than GPT-4. It should be a verifiable pause. Governments should step in and institute a moratorium, which is all very lofty. You can't really see this happening right now. What we will see, and I want to go back to Alan Turing for a second, because in 1948, he was writing about this. He's like, look, there's going to be opposition to these thinking machines, as he called them, because there's an unwillingness to admit the possibility that mankind can have any rivals in intellectual power. And that occurs as much amongst intellectual people as others because they have more to lose. And so really what we're seeing is the rise of a very intellectual class, particularly in technology, starting to worry about whether the machines are getting so good that maybe their very secure positions are being threatened. And this letter, which doesn't really read very technically, it reads very emotionally. You know, people should go and read it because it doesn't really use technical language. It's just quite emotional language. It sounds like people who are really getting worried about losing their power and their roles.
True, but others are also worried about the way this technology can have extraordinary one-on-one reach, right? And this is where we get into this whole area of misinformation or the manipulation of elections, and we know that is a thing. We know it was a thing in Brexit and elsewhere, targeting certain groups with that you believe will be critical voters with very targeted information. And when that information is sitting in front of you as a personable, human-like chat GPT rather than a tweet or a some other kind of online advertising, we're into interesting territory. Are we already seeing politics adopting this technology?
Possibly behind the scenes, and you may be drafting mass letters to constituents or things like that. I don't know if we're really seeing it drive the development of policy yet. And I think, again, this is where it's going to become very thorny because AI has blind spots based on the data that it's trained on and also based on the kinds of interactions, the kinds of questions, the kinds of relationship that you're building up with that machinery. Because the more relationship you build up, the more you kind of have an apparatus in your own head that will condition the kinds of questions you're going to ask. I think There's a couple of things going on here. I think taking 6 months and going, let's actually have a discussion about how we want to use this versus how we can use this, I think that's a fantastic idea. I think that in practice, people are going to keep charging forward now as fast as they can. Some of that's going to be greed. Some of that's going to be lust for progress. And so I think we kind of almost need to be able to ride both of those horses because I do think it's a really good moment for all of the reasons that you've highlighted here about noise and disinformation and adding to the chaos of the world, that we actually pause enough to see how much we can rein that in.
We were going to touch on, but we'll skip over it, the New York Times reporting on a conservative or right-wing ChatGPT that had been trained on, I think in its words, fake news. There could be chatbots, as we say, we've just been discussing for every political disposition, right? So let's just add to the noise. Is there a way around it? What does Wikipedia think? Does it think it's got the answer here?
So Wikipedia is working with DuckDuckGo, which is one of the search engines that promises not to track you very much, to basically create an AI engine that can fact check. And the question here is that going to be good enough? Is it going to be better? Is it going to be good enough? I think we need to see a lot of research in this area, and we need to have multiple teams. And hopefully, right now, there's a lot of PhD students who are actually working very hard on finding ways to actually get machines that have some testable veracity and a machine that will actually test its own truthfulness before it tries to convince you what it's saying is correct. These things are possible. I think until a few months ago, Catherine, we weren't even aware we needed them.
No, it has come very, very quickly, hasn't it? Mark, thank you very much. Mark Pesce, futurist, writer, educator and broadcaster.